You're listening to Drinking on the Job, DOTJ. I'm your host, John Coyle. Drinking on the Job is a toast to the culture of food, wine, and all things fermented. We'll be talking with winemakers, musicians, artists, late-night bartenders, scoundrels, and more. It's time to grab a glass before its last call. Have you ever wondered what is behind that incredible cocktail you just drank? Brian Evans, bar director of Sunday Hospitality Group, joins me to spill the tea and name drops some of the coolest places to eat and drink in New York City. Hey, Brian Evans joins me. He is the bar director of Sunday Hospitality Group, includes the lobby bar, El Quixote, Cafe Chelsea, Rule of Thirds. It goes on and on. These are the coolest, greatest bars, places to hang out in New York City, which is a great back-to-back off my Chinese tuxedo episode. But Brian's here. Brian, thanks for jumping on.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me. I'm pretty honored, and surprised. Why me?
Why? Because I sat at the lobby bar. I've eaten at El Quixote. There's something magic about the Chelsea Hotel, which we'll talk about. Sitting having some of the most amazing cocktails, and I'm like, who the hell put this cocktail program together? And then it turns out you're star chef, you're a rising bartender a few years ago. Did a little bit of research. I'm like, okay, I have to have this the cocktail master. Come on.
Talk do I have about a Wikipedia page? Yeah. I don't know about this.
I do my research, man.
Thank you.
So I always start with how did you get here? Give me a little bit of your background growing up, and what was the first spirit you had? How did you get in here?
How did I get here? I ask myself that question every single day, and it's very, very perplexing. But yeah, so I was raised in Fort Smith, Arkansas. You ever heard of it?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. One of the few. Usually a drive-over state. Might have gone out to use the restroom at a gas station or fill the gas, but it is an industrial town. Not a whole lot for me personally, but I lived there for 25 years. I went to school for graphic design, worked in graphic design, also played in, hardcore band and metal band, and traveled the country for a little bit. But in between, I could always rely on my job as a barista at a coffee shop in Fort Smith, Arkansas, which was actually the busiest coffee shop. And it was an invaluable experience for me in terms of stair-stepping into that hospitality world.
Was that the beginning of the kind of premium coffee head kind of era?
I mean, that town... despite it being the second largest city in Arkansas next to the capital in Little Rock, it was still under 100,000 people. We didn't even have a Starbucks until years escape me, but 2002, 2003, maybe. Nothing like this third wave thing that we have now. We had a steady flow of regulars, and it was a fun community to cater to. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of fun bartenders out there really, a lot of them started as baristas, and I think there's something there, right?
Yeah, I always draw the parallel. I mean, there's a kind of obsessive nature, particularly in the third wave, as you talked about, about the coffee, where it comes from, where it's grown, who's growing it, then what temperature is it roasted at, all these crazy details. And there are we all travel now, and you go to San Francisco, and people have allegiance like they do to, their favorite spirit, their favorite wine, their favorite director. We talk about movies, right? It's kind of crazy, but I do find a parallel. So then you leave and you head to I'm building the bridge to you. How do you get to New York?
Let's shorten this bridge because I can go forever. But I was always obsessed with film. But never thought about leaving Fort Smith, Arkansas, but didn't just took when I turned 25, I took a dive and just where's the closest cool city where things are happening, especially in the film world. New York was too intimidating for me. Right. LA was not my thing. And still continues not to be my thing, but
this is not a city. It's a sprawling suburbia pretending it's a city.
That's a great way of putting it. So Austin, Texas was booming in the film world, and I wanted to be a part of that in some way or another. And luckily, having some kind of coffee shop experience, I landed a coffee shop/restaurant gig, and and somehow worked my way into interning for one of my favorite film directors of all time. And
who was that?
Terrence Malick.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Thin Red Line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. He was awesome, working on like three or four different movies simultaneously. Very strange process because he's a guy that notoriously doesn't have a script, a linear script, really. He just has let's just go out and film things and the story will find itself. And a lot of that story finds itself in voiceover. And it's a producer's worst nightmare, and he had three of them.
I was going to say, my voiceover is almost like a parlor trick, to advance narrative. And I'm like, okay, I'd rather see it rather than hear it. I mean, we're watching a movie, it's a visual medium, right?
Exactly.
So bring it on.
He does make up for it in like just these like stunning, like ethereal, cinematic pieces. But, I was essentially a glorified dog walker and coffee getter. And, I went and picked up and dropped off his dry cleaning. But he got to, have lunch with him on a weekly basis. A very, strange but amazing fellow.
We got the sirens. We got the music of the city in the background. I love it.
I know. It's a very stark contrast to, the subject material that Terrence Malick typically films. But, doing that for about a year and a half, I was very thankful to have that window into the film world, but I was essentially an office guy and I really suck at offices. It's too quiet. It's, really weird. I can't really be myself in terms of personality, but I was throughout that time, restaurants have always been there for me. The hospitality industry has always been there for me. So I started kind of graduating, into the finer side of food and beverage service, started getting into, helped open a really cool restaurant called Sway. That was like a Thai casual fine restaurant that had a really strong wine program and wine. I didn't start drinking, by the way. I was a punk rock, straight edge, hardcore kid, whatever, until 25. So restaurants also kind of helped me shape my palate a little bit. But working at this one particular restaurant exposed me to a wine world that I didn't think I would ever be into. And so I was getting heavily involved in wine tastings and building the wine program there as a manager, then an AGM. And then I'm like, what's next? I guess New York, right?
Right.
So I was very inspired by my management team at that restaurant who all came from New York. And they're like, everybody should do New York, especially if you're in the restaurant industry.
I came here with the same, I was in Boston, LA, moved around, and then I thought, had a girlfriend moved here. I said, you know what? Everyone should live in New York once. And then you come here and you get trapped.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing like it.
Yeah, there is nothing like it. Yeah. I'm 8 years in, almost nine, and I still think absolutely the same, if not more strongly about it, right?
Yeah.
Moved here to kind of, I got WSET, Wine and Spirits Education Trust, level 3 certified. And I was like, this is pretty good resume material. And I get here, it's harder to find a job than I thought in a place that I would really meld with. But, everybody reads the playbook that, Danny Meyer had put together, setting the table. And so I immediately wanted to work at one of his restaurants. And so I worked up, I got an opportunity to serve over at Marta.
Oh, okay.
And was gunning for a SOM position for a while. And, after a few months, they're like, well, nothing's open. How do you feel about cocktails, making cocktails behind the bar? I was like, I don't know really how, but I'm happy to learn. If it's a higher point in the tip pool, also happy to do it.
Right on.
So that's what started my cocktail-focused bartending career. And, the cocktail program at Marta, it was very fundamental and basic, and it was a great place for me to start. And restaurant, high volume restaurant bartending is kind of like what I like to say I specialize in, because it's what I have the most experience in. I've never actually worked at a cocktail bar.
Right.
In fact, in our group, the lobby bar is the only thing that resembles a cocktail bar. There's a little bit of a food element, but it's mostly.
It's such a beautiful bar. So we're gonna bounce around.
Please.
First, we'll stay with film, and we're gonna do you brought a non-alcoholic Negroni.
Negroni, yeah. Brought with us in a little bottle here. This is our Cherry Blossom Negroni from Rule of Thirds.
Right. So who makes this?
What?
Who makes this?
Oh, so we do.
Oh, wow.
This is a blend of, there's this new non-alcoholic, I would say more like a cordial style product called Everleaf. Mm. They have an expression called Mountain, where they take very high quality extracts of cherry blossom, strawberry, and rosehip. So it's got a light bitterness to it.
But the bitter catches me, and I wouldn't think it was anything but a Negroni.
Oh, but there's also Martini and Rossi's gotten into the NA game. They have the Vibrante, which is like their red, somewhere between a vermouth and aperitivo. Hmm. And then they have their Floreale, which is a de-alcoholized blanc vermouth. And then there's cherry blossom syrup and
it's delicious. I actually had a NA cocktail at the bar. At the lobby, where I forget which one it was. This is what I like about the NA. I tell people all the time, like, it's exploding, not because people like going dry, because people are finding balance in their life, right? Yeah. If you have a long night, you're meeting somebody. I was meeting somebody at the bar, and I knew I was going to have two or three cocktails, and then I was having dinner after, so I drink a bottle of wine. Yeah. So I have a non-alcoholic, a regular, and a non-alcoholic. I had one cocktail. Then I go have a drink. I split a bottle of wine. I'm fine the next day.
Yeah.
If I have three cocktails. So it's but the other thing I like about it, and this is a weird thing to say, I like the fact that the cocktails are expensive.
I do too.
Because I don't want to feel like, particularly being in this business, I don't want to be that guy sitting at a bar and the bartender, look, that seat has a dollar value. It's worth something.
Precisely.
He gets gratuity on it. And I don't want him like, oh, fuck this guy. It's a $6 cocktail. Like, I'm going to charge me your regular cocktails because like I am here. And what people forget is you are paying for an ambiance.
Yes. Yes.
You're paying for the ambience. So that
1,000%.
Right. And so the non-alcoholic thing works because it's like, first, like I said, this tastes just like a Negroni. Mm-hmm. Okay. NA beer, athletic, Guinness now 00. Awesome.
Oh, we just stocked our fridge. Yeah. My partner and I, we just stocked our fridge with the Guinness 0.0.
It's killer. I had it at Monk's.
Stunning.
On St. Patrick's Day, we did it as a joke, and everyone sat there and got quiet pretty quickly. It was like, shit, that's good.
Yeah. We did not expect this.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this. Now let's go back to the movie sets for a second.
Yeah.
So if you were going to do a movie in one of your restaurants, what bar would you use? It would have to be the lobby bar, right?
Yeah. I mean, the lobby bar, just every piece of that hotel lends itself to cinema just effortlessly. And
it does.
You know, it like when you walk in, it feels like a set piece out of a Wes Anderson film. You know, it has that kind of dollhouse kind of moment, right?
Yes.
When you walk in.
Yeah.
And you know, the creative director, owner of the hotel, just he knows what he's doing.
It's
got an eye for it. It's just like, wow, this is in your brain. And you know, the restoration is so low intervention and tasteful.
There's not many, I mean, there's few bars in the city where I feel amazing at. That is one of them.
Yeah.
Keen's is another.
Yeah.
Raoul's is another. And I was at a Chinese Tuxedo. I don't know if you've been in there.
Love it.
That feels like, and there's something similar. You feel like you're in your own movie.
It's like an opera house,
It's a restored opera house. But like, you do have this great feeling and comfort when you're there. That's what certainly the lobby bar does. That whole Chelsea Hotel. I did a previous episode with William.
It
was just the stories and who everybody's been there. And I think those ghosts still live there.
Oh,
and you could feel them in the rafters, you know?
You know, I think it's worth mentioning, like, you know, when I, to tie in the film and the Hotel Chelsea and everything, like when I interned as a director's assistant, Terry comes in one day, and this is during post-production, and he brings like 8 copies of Patti Smith's Just Kids.
Oh, yeah.
To
Robin
the
Mapplethorpe.
Office. And
great book.
This is like recommended reading / you know, required reading for everybody, even in post-production.
Right.
I didn't get a copy. I was just an intern. But I was curious because, you know, there was like a lot of chatter about how the narrative of the film in post-production started to pivot to a different direction that was heavily inspired by this book. Watching the movie, it's called Song to Song.
Right.
I could see some of that. There's that like chasing after your heroes kind of thing,
right?
And, you know, to this artistic pursuit. But like, I picked the book up on my own out of curiosity, and I was very inspired by it. And this was like one of the 10 things that brought me to New York was the inspiration from this book that grew with me. And to be like, fast forward, you know, 8 years later and be even a fly on the wall within the Hotel Chelsea, let alone some part of the creative process, was just like, That's what I say when I'm like, how the fuck did I get here? Like,
yeah,
that's crazy to me.
It is. E.B. White, you have to be lucky.
Yeah, right? It's luck and hard work, some kind of ratio of the two, and then circumstance, whatever. You know?
But it's so cool. So let's move on to a little bit. Do you remember your first perfect cocktail you made?
That I made?
Yeah. Like you're like, holy shit, I love this. Because I also, we got to figure out like what I'd love to know what your creative process for making these incredible cocktails. But let's start with the first time you hit.
Thank you.
Oh, shit.
So I would say the first cocktail that I made that I was like, whoa, all right, this works. This is awesome. Mm-hmm. I did all the study of and bridging of flavor, you know, synapses like really worked out. The research paid off. I did if I remember correctly, it was a grappa cocktail. I was bartending over at Santino, which is like kind of at the time it was a clubby restaurant at the Highline. With Major Food Group.
Yeah.
Super fun. It's where I got to learn like high volume craft cocktail bartending in a kind of lively environment. But it was a grappa cocktail, grappa sour with red grapes, amontillado sherry, and vanilla bean syrup. And if I remember correctly, there was celery juice in there as well.
Do you know how crazy that sounds? Just putting all that together.
But particularly,
by the way, using grappa. No, I mean, this is like
we were challenged to make a grappa cocktail we had those, I think during January and February, it's slow time for a lot of restaurants. And I remember my bar manager challenging us, you know, a spirit or a couple of spirits to link, on a weekly basis.
Right.
And that was one that like, I was the first one where I was like, I would put that on a menu and I would drink the shit out of it.
Give me a telltale sign of somebody that's running a great cocktail program without naming names. Like you walk in, you're like, oh, maybe. I mean, it's easy to write that sounds something great. It's great to have a great name. But what's not one of your telltale signs? Like this person knows what they're doing.
Well, there's several answers to that I'll try to condense down. But like, you know, if somebody's running a great bar program within a space, you know, you know that immediately and upon how you feel when you take a seat at the bar, right? And that's lighting, the music levels, the attention that the bartender may or may not give you, like right when you walk there. But if I were to base it off of reading a cocktail menu, because I'm always researching. Anytime I go to a place that puts forth a cocktail menu, I'm going to pick from the list. Just out of my curiosity. I always want to see what everybody else is doing, but I typically love to see, I think many other people would agree with this, but like when they leave off certain, you know, culinary items like simple syrup or fat washed, you know, I like a little bit of intrigue. I like a succinct, I like a really tight 3 to 6 words.
Yeah.
That follow the cocktail name.
Little mystery's good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Like you gotta sell. You gotta, undersell, over deliver, right?
Yeah.
To me that speaks volumes. I can usually tell what that cocktail is gonna be, but I love the way that they have written a pop song about it, right?
Yeah, okay. That's a great way to put it. So across the board with the different restaurants, El Quixote, you do that as well?
Yep.
Like, so do you like, in your mind, you have a piece of music and you're like, I think of Bolero and I'm going to put something in El Quixote and I mean, how does that work? Because it's, if anyone's listening, like sit down and you try to come up with like 20 cocktails off the top of your head. It's just like, it is definitely a Rubik's cube of ingredients of tasting, right?
A lot of it comes with experience, you know, and luckily, you know, between Sunday in Brooklyn and Rule of Thirds, Rule of Thirds was the first, technically the second opening I did with the group as a bar director. But between that and the Hotel Chelsea, you know, there was COVID. And when I got back to the R&D labs with, you know, kitchen counter, back of house, and started doing just kind of blue skies research, quote unquote, on just like all these techniques that I'd never thought I had time for, you know, all these flavor extraction, bar prep methods. I just got hyper curious and started, you know, reading up and dialing in more on like flavor profiles and flavor pairings and matrices.
Yeah, I think the amount of like chemistry involved cooking, freezing, dehydrating, rehydrating, using a Vitamix.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, I could see why this, the whole cocktail thing exploded.
Yeah.
Because it just, I mean, the flavor wheel or profile is so wide. The palette is so large that you can play with, like we were just saying, with, you know, savory and, you know, all these, like, you can pull from everywhere to create something really magical.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, the possibilities are endless, and that's, you know, why it keeps me happy. It keeps me really energized and thrilled about this industry, or this specific department of the industry. And, you know, I did a whole lot of research, thankfully, on the company card, and, you know, just pulled a bunch of things, and just sky's the limit.
Any place totally surprise you? Like, look, if we go to Overstory tonight, the cocktails are very expensive everywhere, but there's like, you expect an amazing cocktail. Any place like just kind of blow you away? Like,
I mean, you said it. Overstory actually, like, it's a place that you could easily be disappointed in because there's hype. It's such a process to get to the top. I've been there 6 times, and I think if there was a God, Harrison's doing amazing God's stuff. Work.
You know? I've been there twice. I had dinner, and the cocktail is just like, not only is the view incredible, but the cocktails are really, really good. And I've been out. I do a lot of running around in this business as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's the police behind us coming to chase us again.
Yes, on the law, or on the run from Johnny Law.
But I've been to places, and I don't want to say it because we do business with them, but, like, you know, it was $30 for a margarita in a rocks glass, you know, a 5-ounce rock glass with a big cube and 2 sips done, and it was $30, and there was really nothing special about it. It was $120 with $150 for drinks. I was like, you know what? I would pay close to that. Overstory is not that expensive, but what you get is, like, it's magical.
It's a full package deal, right?
When you hit it.
Yeah, that place, Martini's, you know, Takuma is doing some fantastic flavor experimentation there, and just like the attention to detail and the artistry of hospitality there, everything's just it feels perfect there. Those are my favorite, like, higher.
What's the longest, like, you're obviously batching out cocktails because you do a fair amount of volume.
Yeah.
So what's the cocktail that is the most tedious? And give, like, something like a time lapse of, like, I start here, and it really takes me X amount of time to get this recipe down.
Like, on our menu, or for just...
Or on your menu that you put together. You're like, this is a great cocktail. I'm going to have to batch this, and I'm going to have to time it. And, like, give us an idea of how long it takes to create one of these, like, magnificent...
Well, I'll take one example that, you know, no longer is on the lobby bar menu. Part of, like, you know... efficiently opening a cocktail program is just like, if you are anticipating high volume, if you are anticipating making sure that 200 people that are all seated are getting their cocktails within 8 to 10 minutes, you know, batching is just sort of like, it's an industry standard,
right.
You know, it's how we keep up. But there was one cocktail in particular, also with that engineering in mind, you know not to make the tequila cocktail your most complicated cocktail. You know not to make your vodka cocktail.
Because the volume.
8 touches, right?
Everyone's going to want
Everybody's going to want that. Right. So you need to be mindful of that. But, you know, we had one cocktail that I absolutely loved. It's called the 100th Universe. And I'm not a tequila drinker by any measure, but it was, you know, based off of a sidecar. So is the margarita, but this is like, had the more of a sidecar in mind. Tequila reposado that was infused with mustard seed and mango brandy from Ryan Hall Distillery in Chicago.
Hmm.
What else was there? There was pandan leaf that was cooked down to a simple syrup, and mango puree, lime juice, and sesame oil tincture, basically fat washed Everclear with sesame oil, a couple dashes. But, like, you know, it doesn't sound like the... There was a couple infusions involved, and there was like a 6-touch pickup, and
but you pre-batch that for the bartender, so if he has to do it that night,
we batch the spirits,
right?
Okay. The infused spirits, they just add, they build the puree, the juice, the simple syrup.
Right.
So yeah, we reduce it down to like 4 or 5 touches, but even that, because it was a tequila cocktail, like, you know, it kind of held us behind.
Yeah.
But I was really proud of that one. That was one of my favorites. It's bummer it's no longer with us. It may come back. Who knows?
Yeah, I want to taste it. So we're going to do a alcoholic spirit. We're going to do some pechuga. So this is Yola, female-owned, operated-run, family recipe. Pechuga, which I got to say, I've never had before. Basically, they take a protein and they kind of hang it over the distill, still, and it kind of drips into it. And they can use alligator, chicken, turkey. This is turkey breast, and it just does change the flavor profile. And it's also like oranges, mandarins, other stuff. And it's used basically as a celebration drink. So pechuga is like for wedding ceremonies and people graduating, and somebody falls in love, they drink pechuga. You don't see a lot of it. I don't know. You're probably exposed to a lot of it.
A lot of pechuga that I know of is fairly allocated. Mm-hmm. Like let's take a larger producer affiliate like Del Maguey. Theirs typically goes out of stock when it's released.
We don't get a lot of this. This is T. Edward as well. Yeah. And we get, I don't know, there might be 26 packs or something for the market. That's just
It's
expensive.
Yeah, it's a ritualistic process and a tedious process. And
cheers.
Cheers. Suchi Beo, is that what they say in Oaxaca? I haven't been, but I think that's what they say.
Hmm. All right. So let's talk about seasonal. How often do you change the cocktail recipes in each place? Is it seasonal? Is it so you're in winter now? Springtime, do you start changing? You don't change the entire list, I'm sure. You add or delete, I imagine.
Yeah, it's usually a one in, one out approach. I mean, bearing in mind that everything that we do thus far outside of the lobby bar is basically a cocktail program within a restaurant, and so. Right. You just got to be mindful of how many people you're stressing out when you're doing a menu flip. The only menu flip that we do traditionally every year is at Sunday in Brooklyn. We do this holiday cocktail pop-up starting at mid-November every year, going all the way to January 1. It's called Snow Day in Brooklyn.
That was one of the originals, right?
Yeah. We just wrapped it up. Yeah. We just had our sixth year doing it. That was kind of my first big, contribution to Sunday in Brooklyn and the Sunday Hospitality Group. Still going strong. It's still like a crazy madhouse, high volume of just like overly decorated holiday cocktails. Right. It's super fun. It's awesome. But that is the one menu flip. That is the one that we pull in three different training sessions offsite to get the bartenders fully acquainted. Every drink has, not one, but like five garnishes and then sometimes set on fire tableside. So there's a lengthy process in terms of
the learning training. Curve. And also, what's funny is too, is, before this, I had a friend who used to do similar to what you do, not at the level. And he used to, his sole thing was he would send people into the bar and say, hey, I want you to order this cocktail for me. And he would stand in the corner with a little straw because consistency is the most important part of this. Because first you're paying top dollar, but that's why you batch. Exactly.
One of the big reasons why you batch. Right.
Is so that, so the customer's getting the same thing. They come back hey, I used to go to ABC and get this thing. It was kind of like their Orange Julius and it was spot on the money. And I know it was complicated. And it's a gentleman, Babatou Sparrow, put it together. And he was a creative, innovative guy himself. But it's like that consistency is most important. So to your point, doing something tableside, anything that even has a little bit of that. I don't know if you went to Nubaloo's. They have dry ice on the bar.
I would love to check that place out. I've heard great things. Jose Andreas.
Yeah. All right. So we'll go there.
Yeah. Let's do it.
We'll check it out. Yeah. That's one of my favorite little place. But the presentation is a lot because it's also really important. It's just not the spirit, the ice. There's a glass. Mm-hmm. To take into consideration. I think, I'm trying to think of La Mercerie now. I mean, one of their selling points was they put your cocktail, they have a teeny, teeny little bar though. And the glasses are like $500 Baccarat crystals.
Oh my gosh.
And it's crazy. I would think that the breakage, but there's something about the visual component of it as well in the way something feels in your hands.
Yeah.
Right.
Gosh, yeah. It so adds value.
You're taking that into consideration as well.
Very much so. Right. I am, a devo when it comes to glassware. I love to style out a drink. That I feel like if I had any strength in this, in my position, is I really like bringing personality into a cocktail and having every cocktail on a given menu that's worth its time and print on a menu to have its own individual personality that separates itself from the next thing. And glassware is a huge component of that. And the garnish or no garnish is a big, part of that cocktail's identity too, like whether it's a tiki, whether it's a Manhattan. That being said, I everything Hotel Chelsea is so fairly new in terms of our contribution to the restoration process and the current venues that it was really important to us to let those menu items breathe a little and see, like, get enough data to where to see if what should stay longer or what should be replaced, what is replaceable, you know, what's not working. But yeah, every venue has its own distinct, you know, kind of genre, I would say. Quixote has got, it's a love letter to Basque Country, Spain.
Yeah. I love it. I love Quixote. I love that bar too. And I love, love the barmen are in their like red vests and
it's
like,
so cool.
It's one
of the few time capsules of New York dining, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's been around since 1930 and it's been restored and, you know, we updated the menu, but also paid a lot of strong tribute to, what was available throughout the years and decades. However, you know, of course the pricing is not the same. You can't get, choose your own paella for $20, but
yeah. Or I used to go there and eat paella and drink cheap sangria when I was on a serious budget, but that's what it was good for.
How was the sangria? I got to ask you. I always ask.
You know, it's just, it's good. It's just good. It reminds me of like vin de soif. It's like quaffing, you know, juicy, you know, and particularly stuff that's like, has a lot of like chili pepper or garlic or, you know, spice to it, pimento. I mean, the sugar component works with it. That's why I think it's a great marriage, you know?
Awesome.
But I still love El Quixote. I'll go and just have like Bocaronis, a Pontamat, and some sherry and sit at the bar and be a really happy man.
Because you got good taste, my man.
Yeah. And then I slide right over into the lobby bar.
And then forget how you get home. Yeah. The lobby bar, you know, was more inspired by, I think, the more Eurocentric hotel lobby bar structures of, you know, the world. And we actually opened Sunday in Brooklyn and London, and I was fortunate to be able to drink at some of the more, you know, storied bars old and contemporary and some of the world's 50 best, and pulled a lot of inspiration from that as far as like the menu development. It was a great timing because I went there right a little bit before the lobby bar even opened.
Right.
And, you know, I was inspired by the way that they were extracting flavors. Of course, in London, every mixologist has a rotary evaporator, you know, behind the scenes, and they're creating their own spirits. But I did like some of the approach of how they're extracting aromatics and using that to kind of give this element of intrigue to familiar classics. And so that was kind of the whole name of the game with the lobby bar menu, divided down the middle with that in mind, and then the other half being tributes to several historical classic cocktails. And it has the classic cocktail in the name, but specific to a person or a place, such as, you know, we pay tribute to the Duke's Martini, we pay tribute to the Singapore Sling, we pay tribute to the Arnaud's French 75 from Louisiana or New Orleans.
It's so cool. That's what I mean. I hear people gripe all the time how much a cocktail costs, but I hope they're getting the feel from this interview here, like what goes into it, the glass, the garnish, the training, the amount of spirits, that's, you're paying for a really great quality. Otherwise, just get a shot of beer and
that
shut
too,
your mouth.
Yeah. Well, I haven't even gone into like the bar prep side of it. It's, you know, there's infusions and, you know, proprietary syrups that we're making and just consistency all along the way that needs to be managed. It's a lot, you know. You can go simple, and it's effective, and a lot of people would probably rather stay in that space, and I commend that. I love complicated shit, so but I have to like reel it in, like, for especially for the Hotel Chelsea, it's more of like approachability was key, right? You know, familiarity was key. For every one cocktail that might be on that's on the menu that might be slightly polarizing, you got to have nine more that are just kind of like, all right, this is going to meet the expectation and hopefully exceed it.
Okay.
But Cafe Chelsea, French. We just opened that in July, and it's an all-day French-American bistro.
I have to tell you, that place is charming as all hell, too. It is beautiful. I just sat at the bar and had oysters, and it's just like, it's a beautiful bistro, and it still has that kind of Chelsea magic, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the idea there was, the cocktail program there specifically was more austere than the others and a little more classic-leaning, but left-of-center approach to classics, you know, leaning on French spirits and flavors and eaux de vie and stuff like that. But, you know, you can choose your own adventure. You could never leave that Hotel Chelsea and just feel like you've had just days gone by and very satisfied with several different experiences. It's, you can get lost there. It's great.
All right. So I want to thank you for being on, but now I'm at the time of the show. I'm going to throw you a curveball now.
Oh.
Because normally I ask people, what are they eating, drinking, and listening to? But God says, is going to say, you know what, Brian, heaven's not what it used to be. You know, the expectations, you know, I think I need to put a great cocktail in everybody's hand as they walk through the pearly gates. And I want you to make that cocktail. So I'm gonna, you need to come up here. You're a really old man now. So I'm going to give you a gift. Your last day on the planet. We'll let you know what that is. So what movie would you be watching?
Oh.
What would you be drinking?
Okay.
As you float off into the ethers?
Well, I have trust issues, especially with God. So I'm gonna assign him a cocktail that I know I'll love that he can't fuck up.
And there
that's
you go.
That's right. Straight up Armagnac and tonic. 2 ounces of Armagnac, ice cubes, hopefully not high fructose corn syrup based tonic.
Not God.
Yeah. Not God.
I think he could source some decent ingredients.
I think so. I think so. I mean, if he was going a craft cocktail trained, then I would ask for a Sazerac, 50-50 rye and cognac.
All right.
But let's just do an Armagnac and tonic.
So you're sitting at the most comfortable theater, you got the best seat in the house, and you're watching what movie?
Paris, Texas. Yes. Okay. 1980s kind of road film. That is about a man who wakes up in the middle of nowhere in Texas with amnesia and has to kind of pick up where he left off. We'll figure out how he got there and then pick up where he left off. And it involves, you know, leaving a child and a wife behind, and written by Sam Shepard, which I know you're a huge fan
huge
of Sam
Shepard. Fan, yeah.
Directed by Wim Wenders, a German, German film director. Don't know what it is. I don't know, but watched that movie when I was like 12 years old on the Encore movie channel. Saw it a couple times, and just like something about the atmosphere pulled me in, but the more I watch it, the more I gained from it. And it is, I can't say a single day goes by that I don't think about that movie. So I think in a movie theater, if you know, I'm at some kind of pearly gate situation.
Yeah, drinking your favorite cocktail.
Drinking, you know, my favorite or second favorite cocktail.
So the final credits roll. It says the end. Thank you, Brian.
Hey, thank you, John.
Hey, man. Hey, I want people to be able to find you, you know, the hotel, the restaurant. So what's the best way? Website?
I just do Instagram. Okay. I'm usually hiding from liquor reps, so I'm in a basement somewhere. But I am, in Instagram, I'm at Dad Punk Vibes. That's cool. Me.
All right. And people can find the, El Quixote and all that stuff. Just look them up. It'll Google.
Yeah,
it'll jump out.
Look up.
Yeah. Thanks for being on. I totally appreciate you being on DOTJ Podcast, man.
This was an honor. Thanks for having me.
Cool.
Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to check us out at DOTJpodcast.com. Until then, I'll see you at the bar. Intensa nostalgia in varie